I'd like to move on to the next section of the program, and we are exceedingly lucky and fortunate to have Ian Binney come here on short notice, and it was exceedingly short notice. Ian has had a very interesting career in civil litigation, and he first started his university career at McGill, finished law school at U of T. It's during that course of that period of time that I first met Ian. After that, I think our careers have diverged widely. He has been called to the bar in Ontario, England, and the Yukon. He worked in Toronto in private practice with the Wright McTaggart, and then went to the Department of Justice about 1980, and became Associate Deputy Minister from 82 to 86. And you note that it was during that period that we had the patriation of the Constitution, and I'm sure it must have been interesting times. He, of course, had a connection with the Yukon during that period of time, and the Crown attorneys are federal officers. He then went back into private practice and has been with that huge McCarthy firm in Toronto, and is there now. He's had many interesting cases, appeared in many interesting matters. For example, he was counsel for Canada at the International Court of Justice in The Hague on the Gulf of Maine dispute, boundary dispute. He's appeared in the Supreme Court of Canada many times on such cases as Operation Dismantle, Guerin versus the Queen, the Auditor General versus the Minister of Finance, that was a claim to secret cabinet papers, and Borowski and the Minister of Health, that was a standing issue. He has had a continuing interest in matters involving native land claims. In fact, he had just finished arguing, I think it was for 3 weeks in the Court of Appeal of Ontario, the Bear Island case. And because that case finished on Thursday, that he was able to come here. I understand that that case will squarely deal with the issue of Aboriginal title. He's also counsel for the Yukon in the Kaskadena case. And the topic that he will be talking about is Yukon evolution to provincial status with or without Meech Lake. And he'll be able to give a different light, I think, on the Meech Lake matter, as he was legal counsel for the Joint Parliamentary Committee on Meech Lake. And I'm sure that the federal perspective that he'll bring will be of interest to all of us. So I'd like you to welcome Ian Binney.
Thank you very much, Gordon. As your substitute speaker today, I have certain advantages. It reminds me of a sign that I saw in a small town called Lakefield during the great spring strawberry festival, where over the street there's a huge banner saying fresh strawberries and cream. And then underneath was sort of a handwritten note saying, sorry, no more strawberries, rhubarb being served. And certainly being introduced by Gord as having the federal background that I have only emphasizes the rhubarb aspect in this audience. I should also say that although I've been a member of the Yukon Bar since 1984, I think this cup of coffee is the first return I've had on fees during that period of time as one of your extraterritorial members. I don't have a written paper available, but I did want to talk generally about the Meech Lake Accord and about the evolution of the Yukon to provincial status, perhaps arising to some extent out of the discussion yesterday with Professor Gibson, although I didn't have the advantage of hearing it. I have some idea of the professor's views on the topic. And I think what I want to emphasize as a basic thesis is that in Meech Lake, as generally in matters involving the federal government and the territories, it is not that the territories, and Yukon in particular, is overlooked. It's really to the opposite effect, that the Yukon and the issues raised by the Yukon's evolution to provincial status really lies at the heart of a number of highly intractable federal-provincial problems, so that Yukon and the Northwest Territories are really a casualty in a war that is no part of their making and not greatly to their interest. And that there is a way around this problem of meeting both the interests of the Yukon and not aggravating federal-provincial relations any more than necessary. And as I see it, the Yukon government is pursuing that course of action in a way that I will describe briefly. First of all, on the oversight theory that the Meech Lake Accord grew out of a kind of Mad Hatter's Tea Party where the participants were running around signing documents in the middle of the night, really without much regard to anything other than the necessity for a deal. And that the whole arrangement of Meech Lake was but imperfectly understood, if at all, by the participants. And that perspective was summed up by Marjorie Nichols when she wrote that it was not true that Bill Vandersam had no important role at Meech Lake. She said, his function was to explain the hard bits to Don Getty. The real problem with the Meech Lake Accord is that it arose, as you know, out of an attempt to meet the Quebec demands, five in number. And the great breakthrough of the Quebec demands was to move off arguments about a redistribution of powers and to put the focus on national institutions and to so refashion national institutions that Quebec would feel at ease in the future constitutional evolution of the country. And it was for that purpose that most of the concerns of the Yukon were dragged in sideways, for example, the nominations to the Senate, to the Supreme Court of Canada, and the advance to provincial status. The concern that Quebec had, which arose out of the public hearings before the Joint Parliamentary Committee, was that they wanted to arrive at a point where the amending formula was locked up, and not to leave any room for the federal government through its participation in the general amending formula to create new provinces which would create new numbers for the application of the amending formula. As you know, the background to provincial status is that initially under the Constitution Act 1867, it was done by an imperial order and council or proclamation on the address of, in the case of the Northwest Territories, both houses of Parliament. In 1871, it was altered so that new provinces could be carved out of the Northwest Territories by a simple statute. And this was done both in the case of Alberta and Saskatchewan. There was a great deal of concern
in the late 70s and up to 1982 that, however, matters were locked up as between the federal government and existing provinces in an amending formula that so long as the federal government maintained an ability to create new provinces, you could have the provincial equivalent of Roosevelt stacking the Supreme Court. Unlikely as it may appear, that was a genuine concern according to the province of Quebec. In 1982, against the wishes of Quebec, and you'll recall the night of treachery and all the rest of it, new provinces were rolled into the amending formula. They could be created under the general amending formula of two-thirds of the provinces representing 50% of the population. That left open the possibility in the eyes of Quebec that they could be ganged up on once again. And as with the evolution of talks towards 1982, where they believed that the provinces and the Quebec were all on side with a view to what had to be done in order to patriate the Constitution, there could be another act of treachery, and Quebec again could find itself isolated. And to guard against that possibility, it was of extreme importance to Quebec to nail down an absolute veto over changing the numbers of provinces who could bring about an amendment to the Constitution. So that having been fixed as part of their focus, the relationship between Quebec's interest, which to a large extent was shared by other provinces that the federal government and a group to which they were not a party might manipulate the amending formula, those changes were rolled into the Constitution, and the impact on the Northwest Territories in other respects was, I suspect, not considered. And I don't know what went on at the Meech Lake meeting, but when the representatives of Yukon and Northwest Territories made presentations to the parliamentary committee, one of the very strong points made was, look, we're not asking for a participation in the amending formula. What we really want to do is to entrench the equivalent of Section 92 powers. We want provincial status in the sense that we want to be able to legislate for the North and not have Parliament in Ottawa pull the rug out from under our feet. That's our concern. What that then raised was the necessity of developing some kind of procedure whereby the territories can move from their present status, addressing the issue of entrenchment of provincial powers, addressing the issue of outstanding Aboriginal rights, which have been imposed by Trudeau as a precondition to change in the North, addressing a series of other problems that really identified what were the issues as between the federal government and the territories, and to put those apart from the issues that divided the federal government from the provinces. And it seems to me that the difficulty in Meech Lake is that by the time the participants really focused on the fact that the Meech Lake Accord addressed a problem about territories moving to provincehood that had only peripheral importance to the territories themselves, it was then too late to go back and say, well, look, we can accommodate everybody's interest here by a more sophisticated and complicated system of constitutional change. And that is why the federal joint committee came out with a conclusion saying we agree that the Yukon has a perfectly legitimate objection to what Meech Lake has done to it, and that some of the implications of Meech Lake were not foreseen. But it is not the case, it seems to me, that the omission of the territories
from the amending formula was an oversight at all. It was right at the heart of the dispute between the federal government, the provinces, and Quebec, and was described by the Cabinet Secretary for Federal-Provincial Relations to the Joint Committee as a deal breaker. If we had insisted, he said, on the provincial evolution remaining as it was under the 1982 Act, there would have been no deal whatsoever, because it would have opened up the amending formula to abuse. Now, the other aspect in all, and not have Parliament in Ottawa pull the rug out from under our feet. That's our concern. What that then raised was the necessity of developing some kind of procedure whereby the territories can move from their present status, addressing the issue of entrenchment of provincial powers, addressing the issue of outstanding Aboriginal rights, which have been imposed by Trudeau as a precondition to change in the North, addressing a series of other problems that really identified what were the issues as between the federal government and the territories, and to put those apart from the issues that divided the federal government from the provinces. And it seems to me that the difficulty in Meech Lake is that by the time the participants really focused on the fact that the Meech Lake Accord addressed a problem about territories moving to provincehood that had only peripheral importance to the territories themselves, it was then too late to go back and say, well, look, we can accommodate everybody's interest here by a more sophisticated and complicated system of constitutional change. And that is why the federal joint committee came out with a conclusion saying we agree that the Yukon has a perfectly legitimate objection to what Meech Lake has done to it, and that some of the implications of Meech Lake were not foreseen. But it is not the case, it seems to me, that the omission of the territories from the amending formula was an oversight at all. It was right at the heart of the dispute between the federal government, the provinces, and Quebec, and was described by the Cabinet Secretary for Federal-Provincial Relations to the Joint Committee as a deal breaker. If we had insisted, he said, on the provincial evolution remaining as it was under the 1982 Act, there would have been no deal whatsoever, because it would have opened up the amending formula to abuse. Now, the other aspect in all that is a political question as well. The march to provincial status, the kind of creeping provincialism of recognizing a royal prerogative in right of the Yukon, Bruce's paper, nominations to the Supreme Court and the Senate. And all of that simply sets off alarm bells in some of the provincial capitals. In other words, it seems to me there has to be a clear-cut, agreed program for addressing a series of maybe three or four problems and then really achieving for the Yukon provincial status in those respects which really touch the life of the people in the territories. And if it takes a little longer to work into the amending formula, the resource sharing arrangements, and a very few incidents of provincehood that creates problems south of 60, that may take a little longer. But if you're looking for an all or nothing, you know, we're either a mere territory or we're a full-scale province, it seems to me you're looking much further down the road than if it proceeds in stages to address the Yukon concerns without inflaming the provinces. Another issue which falls into this category, it seems to me, is the question of resolving Aboriginal rights, which is one of the other great items of unfinished business from 1982. And here again, it strikes me that the Yukon has moved in a far more constructive way to meet that issue than have the provinces to the south. As you know, the position of both Ontario in the Bear Island case and British Columbia in the Gitskan case is all or nothing. It's a kind of high noon scenario where the province is saying rights are all extinguished, they're out. Aboriginal peoples have nothing. And the Aboriginal peoples are saying, not only do we have everything, we're sovereign. You know, who are you? Who are these courts? What's this judge? Where did you get authority? So it's really just two solitudes screaming at one another. One's going to lose. And whoever loses is going to be in a very serious fix. The Bear Island case Gordon mentioned in Ontario deals with a Aboriginal rights claim to about 4,000 square miles, just abutting on the Quebec border north of Lake Huron. And this is the traditional hunting ground of the Temagami Indians. The Ontario Crown alleges that they were party to the 1850 Robinson-Huron Treaty. The federal government says that they weren't, but they adhered to the treaty in 1883. The Indians say they never adhered to anything, they never heard of Queen Victoria, and they don't care anyway. And that case is featured by such things. We have a canoe in the courtroom. This is in the Court of Appeal to demonstrate that the canoe has ends in the Temiskaming style rather than the Western Ojibwe style, which is supposed to prove that they are of a different ethnic background of the people who signed the treaty and so on. But the whole appeal, which went on for about 3 weeks, is like the World Wrestling Federation, where the Indians are kind of Hulk Hogan representing virtue and, you know, Queen Victoria. If Queen Victoria were here, you know, we wouldn't be in this fix. And then the provinces reminds me of Adrian Adonis. Adrian is the nasty gay wrestler who comes on dressed in pink, who has no redeeming features at all. And then the federal government is Brutus Beefcake, who is well-meaning but dumb. And so you've got the three of us all circling around in this courtroom amongst the canoes and the maps, and this is supposed to resolve the problem of Aboriginal rights in the province of Ontario. In British Columbia, in the Gitskan case, equally the province of British Columbia is taking a very hard line. You know, somebody went up through that territory in 1700 to string a wire telegraph line. Well, there goes Aboriginal title. And the Gitskan, with a very highly developed culture that's existed there for thousands of years, saying, we never saw him, we don't know anything about half of the so-called acts of sovereignty that you're discussing. The problem that has arisen is really, in my submission, a failure of the courts. What the courts have done over a period of years is to drop teasing references to Aboriginal rights, raising enormous expectations on the part of Aboriginal peoples, but at the same time dropping little hints that, well, maybe it consists of nothing more than fishing and berry picking, thereby raising the expectation of governments that, well, perhaps it's not such a big issue after all. Under the Constitution Act 1982, Section 35 recognizes existing Aboriginal and treaty rights, saying they are recognized and affirmed. Section 37, as you know, set up a series of constitutional conferences.
to identify and define the rights of Aboriginal peoples, not the Aboriginal rights of Aboriginal peoples, but what would become the constitutional rights of Aboriginal peoples, which would be rolled into the Constitution and offer some degree of certainty. What happened in those conferences, which went by year after year without result, is that the Indian people were forced into a position of saying, well, Aboriginal rights may include sovereignty. I mean, if the right is to continue to live on our lands as our forefathers lived, our forefathers governed themselves. So why is there not an Aboriginal right to self-government? And even if it can't be pushed to the full extent of sovereignty, certainly there can be self-governing institutions within the overall sovereignty of Canada, which is not inconsistent with sovereignty of Canada and is not a denial of the Canadian state. So there is no incentive on their part and no justification for their leadership to yield on Aboriginal rights and say, well, yes, I guess it consists of fishing and hunting and berry picking. And if I'd been in their position, I'd have taken the same position as they did, which is to say, look, until we're told differently, we have it all. On the other hand, the governments, having rolled in existing Aboriginal rights into Section 35 of the Constitution, is in a the governments are in a position of saying, oh my God, what have we done? Is it really true that 40% of British Columbia is under the control of the tribal councils, and that everything east of Quebec to Newfoundland, where there are treaties but not land cession treaties, equally open to self-government as seen by Aboriginal peoples. So the whole process fell apart. And the reason it fell apart, in my judgment, is that the courts have given all these teasing references to what Aboriginal rights might be, and they always say, well, of course, we don't really need to decide in this case what they are, and the Council of Prudence is to say nothing. Well, of course, they haven't said nothing. They've raised everybody's expectation to the sky. And the Bear Island case, as an example, went 120 days of trial. And still the judge says, well, I'm not sure I really know enough to say what Aboriginal rights are and what they aren't in this territory. So, under the Yukon claim settlement, a sensible accommodation with that whole problem was arrived at by saying that within the settlement lands, the Aboriginal claims, as nothing in the settlement agreement shall be construed as affecting Aboriginal claims, rights, titles, or interests, if any, in and to settlement lands, except to the extent they are inconsistent with the settlement agreements. So in a sense, there's a bit of an enclave theory that these settlement lands are to be subtracted in some way from the overall governing structure of the Yukon to the extent Aboriginal rights permit. Now, what are Aboriginal rights, as I say, remains doubtful, so there is a floor and a ceiling imposed in the agreement. The floor is that by the agreement, at least the Aboriginal interest in settlement lands is equivalent to fee simple, and it depends on whether it's Category A and Category B and so on. But Aboriginal peoples are relieved of the risk that the court is going to wind up saying, well, fellas, your interest is in berry picking. They at least know there is the right equivalent, and I underline the word equivalent, to a fee simple. At the other extreme, there is also a ceiling on what Aboriginal rights can mean in the Yukon, because there is imposed the overall structure of the agreement in principle. There is a provision for the application of laws of general application and so on that I'll say a word about in a moment. Now, why is this a productive approach? And I want to perhaps indicate four or five things that we don't know about Aboriginal rights, which are absolutely critical to know before south of 60 there's going to be any movement on a resolution of this problem. First is that nobody knows whether Aboriginal rights or Aboriginal title consists of a single right of use and occupation, or whether it's a bundle of traditional economic activities. If it's the former, then there is obviously a good deal more scope for evolution in how you use and occupy land from Aboriginal times coming forward to 1989. If it is ultimately construed by the courts not as title, but as a bundle of discrete rights to pursue certain activities, then the capacity to evolve is greatly narrowed, because if there's a hunting right, it can evolve as a hunting right, but it is still within that basic limitation. The question of the degree to which Aboriginal rights can evolve at all has not been decided by the courts, although the Simon case, a treaty case in the Supreme Court of Canada, said that a treaty right to hunt could evolve so that you did not have to hunt with a bow and arrow and snowshoes, and that rifles, snowmobiles, and the modern accoutrements of hunting were perfectly acceptable. But if that reasoning is applied to a general Aboriginal right to use and occupation, then its ramifications are a good deal broader than in the case of a hunting right. We don't know what extinguishment, what brings about extinguishment of Aboriginal rights. In the Baker Lake case and the Calder case, both of which I'm sure you're familiar with, the courts, apart from treaty and so on, adopted a test that it was the exercise of complete dominion adverse to the right of occupancy of the Aboriginal peoples. Now, the first part of the expression, the exercise of complete dominion, is a sovereignty issue. And it's perfectly clear that there can only be one sovereign. So you have to go beyond the claim of sovereignty. Did the sovereign exercise its authority in a way that was inconsistent or adverse to the continued right of occupation? And there again, the courts, it seems to me, have not helped policymakers in government and in the Aboriginal peoples to solve it, because they're going in two parallel directions without appearing to bring the parallel lines together. On the sort of macro level, taking 4,000 square miles of Ontario, taking all of the legislation that has a bearing on Aboriginal rights within those 4,000 square miles, does it, taken as a cumulative whole, demonstrate the sovereign's exercise of dominion adverse to continued occupancy? A cumulative test. Stand back. Don't look at the detail. If you take the whole thing grosso modo, does it really look as if the sovereign intended that the Aboriginal people should exercise a continuing right to occupy those lands outside the control of government? Then there are at the same time a kind of series of micro cases dealing with specific regulations. In BC, the Sparrow case in the Court of Appeal. An Aboriginal right to fish. To what extent is it extinguished? Is it extinguished by the Fisheries Act? And in Ontario, there's a case called Agawa, which is the same problem but dealing with a treaty right. Well, forgetting all about the doctrines in the extinguishment cases, like Calder, the courts look at the fishing right in the case of Sparrow, and they say, well, regulating the right really affirms it. That regulation is not prohibition.
going back to the sort of municipal law cases, where one might have expected the court to say, well, if it's regulated, then you conduct your fishing by virtue of the regulation, not by reference to the 30,000-year-old Aboriginal fishing right. But the court said, no, no, you don't extinguish by regulation, and therefore when Section 35 of the Constitution comes along and says that the restraints on the exercise of the right which previously were valid may no longer be valid, you're not dealing with a dead right, you're dealing with a sleeping right. And the sleeping right of Aboriginal fishing, regulated, repressed, diminished, is now freed of those restraints, except to the extent of conservation, public health and safety, and so on. Well, why don't we tie those two lines of cases together? Because what it means is that if you look in British Columbia, you see that there are over this enormous area of land, there are settlements where letters patent have been issued, and clearly a letters patent on land is inconsistent with the Aboriginal right of use and occupation. But outside these small settlements, what you really have are enormous areas of resource regulation. And it's very hard to derive from a Crown Timber Act anything other than regulating the harvesting of the resource. It's not necessary for the conservation of the forests that Macmillan Bloedel go in and cut great swaths in sequence around the countryside. The Aboriginal people could carry on exploiting the forests for their purposes without any need of a Crown Timber Act. So where does all this come in south of 60? If you're talking about the extinguishment of Aboriginal rights to the use of land, and you're talking about that extinguished by patents to land, there is a perfectly arguable case that the provinces can't do it. And Mr. Justice Finlayson raised the point the other day in the argument on Bear Island. He said, well, yes, letters, the Land Patent Act, the Crown Lands Act, the Public Lands Act doesn't talk about Indian rights. On the face of it, it's laws of general application. But the only person getting harmed are the Indians. They're the only ones whose interest is being wiped out by the Crown patenting the allodial title to a non-Aboriginal person. You know, is it valid, or does it run counter to the distribution of powers, and there being no federal statute issuing these patents, are even the patents invalid? Then you go to the regulatory legislation, and you look at cases like Sparrow and Agua, and you say, well, all the regulation that's gone on since the 1800s, that's neither here nor there. The regulations presuppose the continuance of the right, so there's no extinguishment there either. And that's why I say when you bring together these strands of jurisprudence, what you wind up with is a real game of constitutional chicken where somebody's going to get badly hurt by the outcome. If you contrast that with the approach in the Yukon and in the Northwest Territories, where there has been an effort to say, well, by way of risk management, let's reduce the area of exposure. We will guarantee Aboriginal peoples that at least there is a floor to what is maintained under the agreement, but we will also assure governments by putting some kind of ceiling to assure that there can be governance in the overall interest of the inhabitants of the territory of the Yukon. In addition to that, there are provisions for the application of laws of general application to the extent not inconsistent with the agreement, so that there is that protection as well. So, to sum up, two of the great obstacles to the federal government dealing with the evolution to provincehood in Yukon has been the outstanding issue of Aboriginal rights. That is equally an obstacle in the Northwest Territories. You'll recall the federal government said, we will never have Nunavut until the Aboriginal rights to the Northwest Territories are resolved. And it was the same policy in relation to Yukon. That problem seems to be on the road to solution. On the amending formula, it seems to me that that can be resolved by identifying the real interest, on the one hand, of the federal government, then on the provinces, and of the Yukon, and that there's no reason that I'm aware of why those interests can't be brought together in some kind of step-by-step progression to full province. So that it seems to me that by identifying the issues that divide the participants and building on the issues that unites the participants, that the provincehood is perfectly achievable, and that in that longer perspective, the Meech Lake Accord is really neither here nor there. Thank you.
Will we entertain any questions or comments?
Did the crowd, did the Imperial crowd ever recognize the Native people or the Aboriginal people as having some sort of sovereign status in the treaties that went into it?
Well, yes. I meant to mention something in response to your question to Bruce. The devolution of royal prerogative under the BNA Act. There's a discussion of that in the Bonanza Creek case, where it was held that apart from retaining control over the statute, the BNA Act itself, it was intended that there be they kissed Canada goodbye. But I suppose there's also the foreign affairs and so on that was reserved to the mother country, but that internally the royal prerogative was devolved with the same division as the legislative division in 91 and 92. And I'm not sure whether one could argue that there was the same, that the Yukon Act shows the same kind of intent of kissing the Yukon goodbye. I rather think to the contrary.
Well, that's difficult to say. Bearing in mind Section 17 says that any act passed by the Yukon is subject to any act required of Canada.
Well, that's right. So it's they're not precisely or perhaps even remotely analogous. On the question of sovereignty of bands, I think that the argument made by Aboriginal peoples that the very fact there were treaties recognizes that they had sovereign status to the extent that it requires sovereign status to enter into a treaty. In the American jurisprudence, in cases like Johnson and Worcester, the Supreme Court of the United States has explicitly recognized them as Indian nations, although dependent nations after the Europeans. The British, I believe, in cases like Imodo Tijani in Nigeria and in southern Rhodesia, addressed the problem. Their premise was that there cannot be two sovereignties, and therefore, to the extent Her Majesty Queen Victoria had asserted sovereignty, the British courts were bound to recognize it. Although, as Marshall said in the U.S., it's a preposterous claim for some puny expedition landing in the Gaspé Peninsula to say, this is for the King of France. So there was no recognition of sovereignty in the British jurisprudence, but within that ultimate limitation, they were prepared to recognize as a kind of historical snapshot the rights of the inhabitants that predated the succession. And that was really a question of historical fact. And that is why Aboriginal rights has this historical flavor. It's not a legal construct. They're saying whatever rights you had at the time of succession, you continue to have. And as I said, the question of evolution is open. It was interesting in the Guerin case that Chief Justice Dixon affirmed that Aboriginal title is geared to the law of succession. And he did not adopt the other theory, which is that really it arises out of use and occupation and can therefore develop after Confederation in areas not directly impinged by non-Aboriginal activity.
So is the question of the Crown, federal Crown in this case, really has an underlying title to all of the lands in Canada, and the issue is to what extent does this special interest group perhaps,
well, the basic theory of Aboriginal title, and this raises an interesting question, because the Aboriginal peoples have a mirror image theory. The imperial theory is that when the Crown asserts rights, it acquires the full and complete proprietary interest in the lands to which sovereignty is asserted, so far as the British courts are concerned. That, as the courts describe it, the Indian interest is a mere burden or a use of the right to use it. And there are all sorts of expressions. They've never actually said what it is, but it's a burden of some sort. And it is disencumbered at the point of surrender or extinguishment by operation of law. So that the Indian theory, on the other hand, which is terrific. I mean, you know, they just hold a mirror up and they say, look, fellas, we were here first. When you came in, we said, by all means, come, share. We'll make treaties with you as independent peoples. You have the right, so long as we agree, to burden our interest with whatever activities you choose to carry on. But ultimately, your interest is defined by us, not our interest by you. And that came fairly clearly out of the constitutional talks, where the Aboriginal leaders, I think, kind of spoofed the whole jurisprudence of our jurisprudence by every time the governments would raise a point, they would simply make the opposite point. You know, it's just a contest of people shouting at each other. There's no right answer, there's no wrong answer. Obviously, our courts are bound by our jurisprudence. But within that, there is so much flexibility and so many gaps that the only way the thing can be settled is by agreement. Yeah?
It seems like the imperial theory that you're talking about is kind of like a right of conquest. Has that ever been sort of formally recognized by British courts?
No, what the difference is that the you can acquire by conquest, or you can acquire by settling and colonizing by discovery. And the rules are slightly different as to whether you acquire by conquest or whether you acquire by settlement. The French Crown did not recognize Aboriginal rights at all. And there's a judgment by Taschereau in the St. Catharines Milling case where he says, what the French Crown gave was not subject to any Aboriginal rights. It was up to the grantee to deal with the Indians either by chasing them away or buying them off or doing whatever they chose to do. Now, that has not been the policy of the British Crown. The British Crown took the view that the European power discovering a territory, discovering, how can you discover people who have been here for thousands of years? But the European discovery gave a right to acquire from the Aboriginal peoples this burden, this interest that the Aboriginal peoples had. Now, if a place was taken by force of arms, by conquest, then different results followed. But the theory to which the British Crown has adhered in North America is that it took by discovery, it imposed on itself an obligation to deal with Aboriginal peoples to obtain the Indian interest on terms acceptable to the Indian and Inuit people. So it's a self-imposed doctrine of law. Yeah?
The BC and Ontario cases that you discussed, do you have citations for them, or can you spell the names?
Yes, the B.C., well, Calder, I believe, is 1974 or 5 Supreme Court reports. Mr. Justice Lissett probably knows the citations by heart. Baker Lake is about 1980. Bear Island was 1984. It's in the Ontario reports that it's a judgment of several hundred typewritten pages. The Sparrow case is now on appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. It would be within the last couple of years in the BC Court of Appeal. But if you look in the latest edition of the Ontario reports, you'll find AGWA reported. And AGWA gives the citation for Sparrow. AGAWA.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Generally accepted that the pre-Section 35, the federal government could have passed an act in Parliament that would have extinguished Aboriginal rights.
Yes. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the doubt under Section 35 is whether that is any longer open. The theory in Sparrow and AGWA is that there was never an unregulated right to fish. In other words, the Aboriginal peoples themselves practiced conservation. They didn't recognize themselves that anyone had the right to kill the last salmon, as Dixon put it in a case. And therefore, because an Aboriginal right is inherently subject to regulation, it carries on being subject to regulation, notwithstanding that it's been recognized and affirmed in Section 35. The problem with that theory is that equally, historically, Aboriginal rights have been vulnerable to extinguishment at pleasure. The Indian interest is held at pleasure by the Crown. Well, is that another incident that's been recognized and affirmed by Section 35? Well, undoubtedly not.
That was the whole point of Section 35.
Well, the whole point of Section 35, I think, was just to try to get a deal that didn't fall apart. And it was thrown into the courts. It's very interesting, the whole process of constitutional change. It's just everybody is pretending that somebody else has the answer. And the politicians say, well, we don't know what the hell an Aboriginal right is. That's the court's business. Let them figure it out. The courts appear to strongly object to having this thrown in their lap. So they refuse to say. And in the meantime, the Aboriginal people who are caught in between the courts and the governments say, well, on the one hand, we can't give anything up because the courts haven't told us we have to give it up. But on the other hand, we have to look to governments to make the system go on a day-to-day basis.
On that business of service and return of service between the governments and the courts, you've been talking about the concept of Aboriginal title and so on. But if you care to comment on the concept of self-government, and either in the context of the constitutional discussions that didn't produce a result, or beyond that,
we
really haven't got involved, but are now being invited.
The self-government being the issue that the constitutional talks collapsed on is the key issue. It seems to me that in legal theory there's no question but that there can only be one sovereign, and that to the extent Aboriginal self-government is asserted as a form of sovereignty, as it is in the Gitskan case, that it is inconsistent with the rights of the imperial sovereign, and was therefore extinguished when claims to sovereignty were asserted by Queen Victoria. Now that is not really an answer to the whole question, because the fact is that for generations after the assertion of British sovereignty, there continued to be self-government
of the bands. Queen Victoria really did not know about the Temagami Band or the Gitsgan Wet'suwet'en Band in British Columbia. So that there could be a coexistence if one defined self-government as something short of full sovereignty. And as far as the Aboriginal peoples are concerned, it seems to me totally unnecessary for them to push it as far as full sovereignty. If that is how it is defined, I think there is authority in the proclamation where the colonies are identified, and it is clear that the governors of the colonies have no authority over the Indian territory. So there is, to that extent, some explicit recognition that Aboriginal peoples would carry on within Indian territory to govern themselves. The next step in that argument is say, well, along comes the Indian Act and it imposes a system of government. And up until Sparrow and Agua, I would have thought the better view was that that right of governing had been so regulated by the Indian Act that after passage of the Indian Act, 1868 and onwards, that there really was no room to say that any Aboriginal rights to self-governing had survived. Now what Sparrow and Agua seem to be saying is, well, you know, the Indian Act regulates self-government, but it didn't extinguish it. That it may well be that those rights to carry on living on the land as our forefathers lived for so long repressed and structured by the Indian Act, now emerge as rights which are capable of being exercised as Aboriginal rights. And it seems to me that on the basis of Agua and Sparrow, that's a perfectly plausible argument that can be made and will be made. It's now official. Time for coffee.